Welcome to Music from the Tower, highlighting the beauty of sacred and classical music. We come to you from the Tower of Hope on the magnificent campus of Christ Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. Now, here's your host, John Romeri.
And welcome to Music from the Tower. This is John Romeri, and I have one of the most sought-after organists anywhere in the country, and we are so thrilled that she's right here in Los Angeles, Isabel Demers. Welcome, Isabel, to Music from the Tower.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Oh, what a pleasure for us. I can't wait to hear your playing, but I've heard you so many times, especially in Philadelphia. I heard you at the Kimmel Center. I heard you play the Wanamaker organ. You know, you are just a force to be reckoned with in the organ world. I've got some quotes here, and I think our folks need to hear these things, because my favorite one is this. Isabel was brilliant in every respect. She left organist's jaws on the floor with her boundless technique, her passionate musical expression, and her rare ability to make complicated forms absolutely transparent. I love the organist's jaws on the floor. Organists hate everything. You know how we are. But everybody finds all this criticism. Nobody ever finds criticism with Isabel Demers. You are a phenomenal, wonderful player and a student of our favorite, Paul Jacobs. Paul has been one of the guests, and so we want to talk about Paul. But you yourself are an organ professor now.
I am, and if you keep going like this with all those quotes, I don't think I'll... My head will be so big after all the quotes.
I could go on for hours here. I have so many pages. I have more pages than I normally do because you are so phenomenal.
As I said, I think my head will be too big for the doors.
So. I don't think so. So you are at Baylor University.
Tell us
about that.
Yeah, I'm very fortunate yet to have a position like that. It's great. What can I say about it?
How many students in your studio?
I have 9 majors now. I started with 1, and then we've been rebuilding.
Of course. They're flocking to you, I'm sure.
Yeah, I don't know, but I have probably the most supportive division head you could hope for, so that's really wonderful. And we have more pipe organs per student than anywhere else in the States. I think we have 10 pipe organs on campus. So I have
to count
them. And then a few electronics as well.
So. And what is your concert instrument? Do you have a recital hall?
Yeah, we have 5 that are in teaching studios or concert halls. We have a big 4 manual, Petty Madden. And then my personal favorite, and maybe I shouldn't say that, but we have this really beautiful 3 manual.
We won't tell anyone.
Yeah. Well, they'll think I'm Canadian, so that's why. But we have this 3 manual Letourneau tracker that is just a little gem. It's absolutely stunning.
Yes.
The best action you could hope for, and the sounds are just so
What a wonderful
beautiful.
Way to teach your students with all sorts of actions and all sorts of instruments.
Yeah, we're very
really
lucky.
It really makes a difference, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, well, even for me, I've been very spoiled. I can practice on any type of action I want. They're all right next to my office, so I have a choice. Every time I need to learn something, I can...
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
We're going to talk a lot about what it's like to have a teacher who is a performer.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to talk a little bit about your background in the next segment, but you were a student of Paul Jacobs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's one of the greatest performers we have in America and one of the greatest teachers. Would you agree?
Oh, definitely. I would agree. I would say maybe not one of the greatest. You could just say maybe the greatest.
The greatest.
Yeah,
No bias there.
No bias there, of course.
Well, I certainly agree. He certainly has taught some of the best players anywhere, and they all have the best jobs. They have Baylor University. We're certainly lucky to have David Ball, one of his students, right here on our campus. But if you look around the nation, his students are really in some of the best places.
Yeah, I agree. And in both church and the concert world.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, you have taken the concert world by storm. Every time I turn around, you're also a featured performer for the American Guild of Organists. In 2008 was your first time to play for mm-hmm. a national convention. And you wowed them. In 2010, you played for the American Guild of Organists and the IOS convention, which was kind of going concurrently, wasn't it?
It was actually a little bit, it was like a month and a half later, but I think for the first and maybe only time, the organ builders from North America and Europe all got together in Montreal. I guess it's you know, the European city of North America. So they all came and then they saw all the beautiful instruments we have up there.
And is Montreal your home?
Yes, sorry, Montreal is my hometown.
Yes, so you're a Canadian by birth, And what brought you to the United States the first time?
I came to study with Paul.
With Paul Jacobs at Juilliard. Well, it's certainly a famous place with a famous teacher and makes famous players, and it's certainly true. Well, as long as we're on the subject, let's talk about your beginnings. What brought you to music in the first place? Do you have a musical family?
Everybody in my family is in sciences, so they're all engineers and pharmacists.
So what brought you to music? Was there a person nearby, or you just had that interest?
My mother really wanted her children to learn music. So I have three siblings, and all of us learn an instrument. I was given piano, I guess. I was told I was going to learn piano.
Yes, well, okay.
And my sisters played violin, and my brother played flute and guitar. So we all learned music, and then I guess my siblings eventually dropped out. They liked it, but I think not enough for a career.
It wasn't their career,
and I thought about other things too. But
your parents were not musicians.
My mother did piano when she was a teenager, and she really loved music. But she realized that she didn't have really the temperament for it, and she was very nervous. And she thought that making a living as a musician would be very hard, so she went into pharmacy.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, you hear that all the time, don't you?
Yeah.
You know, people that just, you know, they had the musical talent, they had the background, but they were just afraid, you know, that maybe music wasn't going to do it. I've even had wonderful students that I was encouraging to go into music, and the parents wouldn't have anything of it.
Yeah.
You know, they just absolutely, there's no way to make a living. Well, meanwhile, they're talking to somebody who's, you know, been blessed in many cathedrals and many wonderful musical jobs, but not everybody's as lucky as we are.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's talent. Sometimes it's just plain old where you are and when you are.
Yeah, I agree, yeah. And I think back then, I mean, not that my mother is that old, but I think back then that wasn't quite like a career choice like we have today.
Yes, I think now people see it more as a profession. But it's not an easy one, is it? You know, the idea of most organists really going to church work. And, you know, the organist is sometimes used in church and sometimes not. You know, we just opened a brand new church here. There's no organ in it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so does the organ have a future? Is there going to be organ departments in these colleges? So we'll talk a lot more about that as we go along today. But so you started on the piano.
I started on the piano, yeah.
And when did you come to the organ?
So, again, it was my mother.
Really like your mom more and more every time you talk.
When I was 16, I guess, she suggested I start taking organ lessons, not because I had shown any interest really for it, but she thought I'd be good for it, and then it was a good way for me. That's how I started. It was a good way for me to pay for my piano studies.
Yes.
My goal was to do my undergrad at home and then go and study abroad. So, you know, I started working for the church, and I saved all my money, essentially. And then I thought, you know, it's going to pay for my future piano studies.
So did you play organ in church right away? How long did it take for that to happen?
Yeah, I had a church job right away. Now, the type of music that the Catholic Church does in Quebec is not terribly interesting, if I may say.
You may.
Whenever I cross the border again, they might try to stone me or something for saying that.
No, it's true. Just a handful of Catholic churches all over the world, really. I was just in Italy with our children's choir. You know, you've certainly traveled all over the place and gone to Catholic churches. You know, we all know firsthand that there are many, many parishes doing music that is really substandard music.
Yes,
it's
agree.
Really not music written by great composers at all. It's music written by songwriters. And there's a big difference, isn't there? And when you think of the church and the history of our Catholic Church, the great music which it brought into life, you know, the Mozarts and the Bruckners and the people that, you know, really the church spurred them on to this great music. And you think of what some of the music that we're passing on to our children. That's why we're so happy here at Christ Cathedral and so many other wonderful places where we have children's choirs and we're nourishing them with great music. And, you know, it makes me so happy to be doing that now in my fourth cathedral all over the place. But it's not the case everywhere. You know, we've had other guests that came in, the wonderful director of music over at St. James in Los Angeles, talked all about the great children's choir he had, you know, and how, you know, it led him to music. And so was there music that came from the church that led you to this playing of the organ, or were you introduced to the organ in church?
Yes, but again, I don't think I had didn't really have any sort of special interest for it. I mean, I think I came to the organ really because I liked classical music. I mean, I was already a student at the pre-college in Montreal.
Yes, you started pretty early.
Yeah, I started when I was 11 there, and, you know, we'd go there 3-4 times a week, and I was a pianist, so, you know, we'd have all Saturday and a lot of evenings.
Wow.
And with a lot of kids my age, I mean, who played violin and
whatnot. And you were still in regular school as well as the conservatory.
Yeah, so we would do both, and, I mean, I really love classical music. That was my great love. And so then playing for church, the music wasn't terribly interesting, but as I said, it was a good way to get some money. I mean,
yes.
That sounds really terrible, but
no,
the music wasn't terribly interesting. And the first year, I have to say, when I started learning the pedals, I had to practice quite a bit. But then after that, it was easy. And I just remember I'd have choir rehearsals, and actually I was learning Italian on the side, so I had a book open next to me, and then I played whatever it was for rehearsal, which was really easy. I mean,
yes,
so
music was simple.
Yeah. Not really paying attention, but then I had the sort of more classical side of all of this at the conservatory, which was
somewhat more
pressing.
And was there a teacher there that taught you the organ at the conservatory?
Yes, I did my undergrad as a double major. So I did piano, really, that was my main focus. And then I did maybe 2-3 hours of organ every week, you know, just enough to get by and graduate.
But well, this is pretty interesting coming from one of America's greatest, finest concert artists to hear that the organ was a little sidelight where she made a little change to pay for her piano lessons.
I think part of it is because, you know, you could in Montreal you could go to, say, piano recitals and you could see all the potential that there was there, you know, but on the organ side you would just become a church organist. I mean, it's really not as developed as it is in the States. So.
Yes, you know, and we think of there are really two tracks for an organist, really,
yep.
Aren't there? Really three, I guess, if you count teaching. But, you know, church organist, and you could either just be a mediocre church organist forever,
yep.
Or you could really rise to the top and be in some great places with some fabulous organs. Or you could be an organ teacher in a college,
Although
sometimes departments close, you know, so it's always a little tricky. Well, let's hear a little bit from this amazing artist. How about a piece by Bach? Will you tell us about this piece?
This is the first piece I recorded, I guess, in 2010, before I finished at Juilliard. I was thinking of doing a CD before a convention. And so, you know, thinking what would work on the organ, and then we settled on the Bach Prelude Fugue in D major, 532, because it has such a joy.
You're going to hear that joy coming right from the fingers of Isabel Diemers, and we will be right back with Music from the Tower. This is Relevant Radio and Music from the Tower. Here's a little Bach. Thank you. back. You're listening to Music from the Tower, and we have the Grand Dame of the organ here, Isabel Diemers. It is such a pleasure to have you on the show, and we're finding out a lot, a little bit at least, about your beginnings and your time in learning in Montreal. And we just, as we took a little break to listen to some Bach, we just found out you were nickel and diming it, making some money to pay for your piano lessons in the church on the organ. So what really led you to move to the organ full time? So you got a degree in organ at the end of the conservatory time.
Yes. So I, as I said, I was a double major, so I did both piano and organ. And then my goal was to finish my undergraduate degree in organ, and then I moved to Paris, actually, to study piano. And I thought, well, you know, I'm done with organ.
In the capital of the organ world.
And I was doing piano. I really still did not have such a strong interest for the organ. I mean, of course, I heard the great instruments there and all of that, but that wasn't really my main focus. And then after...
So in Paris, you studied no organ?
No.
Yeah. Wow.
I was, after about 6 months there, then I, you know, decided that I wanted to move back to the States and study in the States. And so I applied to some schools. But really, before applying to the schools, I didn't really practice any organ for about 6 months. I think I must have practiced maybe 20 hours over 6 months. Now, I did a lot of piano, so, you know...
Your hands were going.
Yeah, my hands were going, and then I guess I kept up the paddle technique just enough to be accepted at the schools. But yes, still
so
it was...
So when you applied, you applied as a piano major and an organ major,
yeah,
a double major?
Yeah, and then I realized actually that I liked organ far more than piano. I mean, I really missed it because I wasn't playing much organ when I was in Paris, so that's something that I missed. So then
and
I decided that...
You heard the great organs of Paris.
I did,
you know, as an organist, that's where we all aspire to go. I was so lucky as a student to get to go to France and, and do some study. When did you get introduced to the real organ repertoire? Did your teachers begin to give you that kind of repertoire?
Oh, yeah. I mean, even when I was an undergrad, I mean, my first year of organ, I played trio sonatas and things like that.
Wow.
So it's not like I played any bad music.
Don't start at the top or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the hardest pieces ever.
Yeah, I thought, you know, how difficult can that be? Only three lines, right?
Only three notes,
it looks very easy, yeah.
And then you go back to it the next day and think, have I ever played this piece at all in my life?
I know, it's like so difficult.
They go away so quickly.
Yeah. I mean, I already knew some of the repertoire. I just didn't really understand what potential there could be as an organist. I mean, see, for me, being an organist was still you'd play for funerals, like in a B3 or something like that. Yeah. So anyway, I realized that I really liked that better. But I think I really understood, you know, how great a career and you know, how great really the organ is, only when I got to Juilliard and started working with Paul.
Well, it's a teacher like Paul that can turn that life around, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because
yeah.
Paul can take any little simple piece that all of us would play on two stops, and he could just turn them into, you know, the way he uses registration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so certainly his introduction to the stops and the use of the organ, the creativity on the organ, was that like a whole new world to you?
Oh, yeah, I mean, completely. I just remember my first organ class at Juilliard, the first studio class we had, I played some Reger. I had never played without an assistant. In Montreal, you always had somebody pushing your pistons. Even if you played the piece that had only right hand, you would have always had somebody pushing pistons for you, which is really silly when you think about it.
Wow, I grew up in the wrong country.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to do all that myself.
Exactly. So I remember that I asked Chelsea Chan, actually, if she could push pistons. So, you know, there she is. And we hadn't rehearsed anything. She just sort of tried to do what was in my score, and that was probably not the best performance.
Let me back up here. Your very first piece in organ class was Reger?
Yeah, it was the first sonata. I had a concert to prepare, and I had decided to play Passacaglias, and so that sonata ends with a great
Passacaglia. Wonderful Passacaglia.
Yeah, but I actually like the first two movements of that piece better than the Passacaglia, but that's another topic. But anyway, I decided to play the whole piece. And I remember the lesson after studio class, Paul said, you know, you're just never going to do this again. Like, you have a week to learn how to use pistons. Here's how you do it.
Wow.
Which was good. I mean,
That's a whole new insight. I never had you know, when you think of the organist and the guild, you know, in the old days, you would have your own students in this little guild, and the first students would be around the corner pumping the instrument, and your finest student would be at your right hand doing the stops, and your next finest student would be at your left hand doing the stops, and you'd just be playing.
Yep.
So was that same sort of mentality?
You would have your, we just helped one another. So you'd have, you know, the student that was maybe the year before after you, and then he would be your stop puller, and then you would be his stop puller, and... So anyway, so...
So he said none of that.
He said none of that.
That Paul Jacobs, he's a slave driver, isn't
he? I know. Do your own, yeah.
So. And of course, he probably wanted 10 times more stop changes than you were already doing, right?
I actually really thought he was crazy because if you know that sonata, it starts and it's all octaves in the pedal, right? I mean, it's all like very thick chords and then the pedal is double pedal. And then he was saying, here you can push one and here you can push one. And I was thinking, but like how? I already have 8 fingers playing and both of my feet are busy and you're telling me I have to do also the box and push pistons. That's impossible. But
so he showed you maybe, how, didn't he?
Yeah, he said, here, maybe you can drop a note here and here you can do this. And then I think what was very motivating for me is I had grown up with a system where you learn maybe 5 pieces per year and, you know, you just spend so much time with them and you didn't really have to work all that hard every week in a way. I mean, on
and
the piano.
And then you came to Juilliard where you had to play a new piece every week.
Yeah, exactly. And most of it memorized. And I never even heard of people playing the organ from memory. Of course, as a pianist, that's what I did on the piano, but not on the organ. So it was a very new world for me, I guess.
Well, and it had to be inspiring to see Paul, not just as teacher, but also performer.
Yes.
And I'm sure your students are just in awe of your own playing and to have that to aspire to.
Maybe, but I think it's good if they also realize that a lot of, I mean, I hope like, okay, I guess I play better than my students, but it's just because I have more years of practice.
Of course.
And that's what I want them to see. It's not just, I don't really want people to say, oh, well, you know, for you it's easy. It's not easier for me or for Paul
it's
or for anybody else.
Easy.
It's a question of how much you work at it.
Paul is in town this week playing a recital at the Sigerson Center,
yeah.
As he's done so many times. And just speaking to him yesterday, he's freaking out because he had very little practice time.
Yeah.
I have a recital in 2 weeks, and I just got home from Rome, and I'm just spending hours on the bench every day because I feel like those pieces have slipped away. They were pretty good in December, and now I haven't played for
uh-huh.
3 weeks.
Yeah.
And so I think for all of us, it's a constant keeping them up.
Yep.
You know, and it's not just keeping up all the notes, but as you said, it's also keeping up where those piston changes
mm-hmm.
come, where the boxes move, all of the other things that are sort of mechanical in nature,
yep.
But make the organ the organ.
And I find also understanding the personality of each organ and how you should play each piece so it sounds, well, as good as you think it can be on that organ. I mean, I find like each instrument dictates a little bit how you play it. And then you have to adjust your playing.
Well, and I think that's one of the hallmarks of Paul
uh-huh.
In his playing is that he really dives into the instruments. You know, many artists come and they're maybe a little more purist, you might say. And if the score says you add an oboe, they put on the mm-hmm. oboe. But if the oboe on that organ doesn't sound so good, then Paul might choose something else.
Mm-hmm.
And other organists would say, no, it says oboe, you have to use oboe.
Yep.
You know, or if there is no oboe, then you add nothing.
Yep. Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's knowing that characteristic of the organ and just diving in.
Mm-hmm.
That takes time. You know, we've talked to other instrumentalists. I mean, as a pianist, you sit down and the piano's the piano.
Yep.
You know, and think of a violinist. They come, they open their case, they know every idiosyncrasy of that instrument. And they just sit down and play. They don't have to worry about anything. And every time we sit down at an organ to play anything, it's a new instrument.
Yep, it's a new experience. Yeah.
And so that means two things. That means we have to discover what that instrument, its characteristics, its flaws,
mm-hmm.
Its notes that don't work, its pistons that
yep.
don't push, and the possibilities it opens for every single piece we play.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what is exciting about it, is that you get a new perspective on the music you're playing, even if you play the same piece 300 times, because it's 300 different organs. It's going to sound different every time.
It is. And sometimes I find myself, at least for me, I find that I kind of learn something about the piece because I think, wow, I love this sound. And I think I'm going to solo this little thing
yeah.
out.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know,
I agree. Yeah.
And there's just something. And I hadn't done that on the last 10 times I played the
yeah.
piece.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, this organ somehow inspired me to
Yeah, to try something different
with
a piece
different.
Yeah, you've played many times before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you're here in Los Angeles to play on First Congregational's organ, really the largest church organ in the world.
Yeah.
And it's bigger than our Hazel by just a few stops.
Just a couple, yeah.
Just a
couple. One or two, yeah.
Yes, and they, you know, they did that when they stole Fred Swan away from the Crystal Cathedral. They said, well, we can't just have the organist from the largest organ in the world. We have to have
the largest
more,
organ,
or
yeah,
we
more,
have
yeah.
to make the organ bigger.
Yeah.
So how is it playing that instrument? Is it thrilling?
I was very, very impressed by the instrument. Well, I am, I should say. But obviously, I had always heard about how big it is, right? But I had also heard from people that perhaps it doesn't entirely work. So, you know, a lot of those big organs, it's just, you know, the front organ is going to be one thing and the back is something else. And then they added this on the side and this and that. But they never had any sort of conception for the ensemble. I guess I was just really blown away by how beautiful the instrument
the
is.
Instrument
and
is.
Then when you are in the room, even though the aesthetics at the front of the Skinner and the Schlicker at the back, they're very different. But I find, like, if you're careful in how you register it, it really works. And what's even better, in my opinion, is you don't have to use all of it together at the same time. There are places, I played at the Freiburg Cathedral last summer. And they have four organs there, and they told me, you know, you really have to use the four of them together as much as possible, because otherwise there's going to be places in the building that have no sound, or these sort of weird holes. So they said, you know, use a little bit of everything all the time, but it's difficult because it's something like, you know, a baroque organ, and then like French Romantic,
yes,
German Romantic, yeah, like
they?
Then English Romantic. I mean, so it doesn't quite go together, I think, and so you try to make something out of it. But I thought that at First Congregational, the nice thing is that it all blends in really well. So you don't have to worry so much about it sounding like two different organs. It really sounds like one instrument.
It really, really sounds like an instrument. Well, and I think that's what people say about Hazel. I've not gotten my hands on Hazel.
Yeah.
We're waiting desperately for it to return, and everybody's so excited about its return. But I think the idea of it blending together was the genius of Virgil Fox and Richard Unfrey and some of the people that put it all together. But it did seem to work.
Yep.
You know, that it really became a cohesive instrument. And isn't it fun to have instrument in different parts of the room?
It is.
You know, for me, that stereophonic effect or quadraphonic effect is something that no other instrument can achieve.
Yeah, I agree. And sometimes, you know, if you're not quite sure what to do with something, if you just change where the sound is coming from, it doesn't matter if it's not the best registration you've ever done. Just the fact that it comes from a different part of the building.
Yes, it adds so much interest.
That does it. Yeah.
To the instrument. Even playing with students, you know, playing a simple piece, I'll go, now repeat it and just have it come from over there.
Yeah.
You know, and all of a sudden the piece is twice as long for them to play as a little prelude. And there's just the interest of the organ.
Yep.
You know,
it's
a wonderful instrument, isn't it? Aren't you glad you came over to our side?
I am definitely, very glad.
Well, so is the organ world. My goodness, one tour after the other. Your tour in 2002 led you to California to premiere in the Davies Hall and Disney Hall.
Yeah.
That must have been pretty exciting to play in symphony halls like that.
Yeah.
Isn't it great to see more and more organs going in our symphony hall?
It's really fantastic. And to see so many of them doing really well, too.
Yes, and being used with the symphony.
Yep.
And, of course, people like Paul out champion.
Yep.
Championing commissioning works for organ and orchestra. We're getting ready to commission one for the opening of Hazel as
Good, excellent.
Something for organ and orchestra. Have you played in our Segerstrom Center here in...
I haven't.
Okay, we must fix that. We must have
I guess I'll hear Paul tomorrow, though. So,
yes, it's going to be great. And we can't wait for you to come and play Hazel as well. That's going to be wonderful. Well, I think it's time for us to hear a little more music, isn't it? You recorded an entire CD of Reger. We were talking about this wonderful romantic German composer just a minute ago. Tell us about this piece.
Well, so actually when I was finishing up my master's with Paul, I had to find a program for the recital, for the graduate recital. And he suggested doing the Durflay Suite and then Reger's Three Chorale Fantasies, Opus 52. So... I guess I learned these three at that point and then decided, you know, when I was a doctoral student, why not complete the set? And so I learned all seven. And then the doctoral program has this wonderful scholarship from the Presser Foundation for a special project. So I submitted a proposal and I got the scholarship. And I guess I was able to record all seven of them in Amarillo, Texas, of all places.
Wow.
And that's really amazing Skinner, Alien Skinner, G. Donald Harrison, 1941 or something like that.
Sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Sounds perfect.
A bit like a smaller version of the Mormon Tabernacle, but absolutely stunning instrument.
Wonderful.
So this is the last one, yeah.
This is the final one of the seven?
Of the seven, yes.
Wonderful. Here's A Little Rigor by Isabel Demers. We'll be right back. Back to this episode of Music from the Tower. This is John Romero, and I am here with Isabel Demers. Isabel, you are just a fascinating person, and we're meeting for the first time. So I feel like I'm learning just as much as our radio listeners here, finding out all about you. I knew of you. I've certainly heard you play several times, but it is a pleasure to get to meet you and get to know a little bit more about you. We're going to look forward to your performance here in L.A. We're going to certainly look forward to welcoming you back, but we've been talking about your time with Paul Jacobs, certainly one of the great teachers of America, and just what it was like. So now you're coming to the end of your doctoral studies. You've made recordings already. You've done concerts all over the place. So did you have a what's next, you know, moment? Like, okay, well, this was fun, but what am I going to do now? Or did you already begin to have offers? Were you already playing concerts? How'd that work for you?
So in 2008, when I played for the convention, what happened is Michael Brone had put together a Pipe Dreams live concert, and then somebody canceled. I think it was Diane Bish, but don't quote me on that. Maybe I'm wrong. Anyway,
won't tell anyone. Don't worry. No one will know.
Somebody canceled, and so he had heard me in studio class and asked if maybe I would fill in. So that went pretty well, I think. I was very fortunate. I had the best music of the evening to play, so that was fun.
Well, I don't think it was just the best music. I've stopped reading quotes a few times ago because I'm so interested in you, but hers is the kind of performance that leaves you breathless. That was one quote. Our concert was superb. It was riveting. I just love all these quotes. You just have a whole bunch, but your conviction and your performance are always thrilling. You know, the last performance I heard you play was at St. John the Divine for the New York chapter.
Oh, yeah. That was fun.
Oh, what an evening that was. We were just organists in the room by ourselves, really. It was the end of a long conference day, and you just thrilled the pants on off us in that wonderful, wonderful space.
I was going to say, yeah, when we have an organ like that, you know, it has the power, the subtlety, everything you could want.
And, well, you showed every ounce of it off.
Well.
So Did you think, well, I'm going to be a teacher, I'm going to be a church organist, I'm going to be a concert organist, or I could do all of that? What did you think?
So in 2008, I was still doing my doctorate. I still had to do my dissertation and everything. But so what happened? I played for the convention, and then I got under management with Truck and Broad. And so I think I would have been happy also as a church organist, but then I find it's difficult if you start concertizing to also have a church position, unless you can have a position that you can split with somebody.
Yes, or
otherwise,
the artist in residence.
Something like that, where you can have some free time to travel and concertize. But if you're at a church where you have to be there every Sunday, obviously
yes,
you cannot be gone for concerts.
The choir's counting on you.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very difficult.
And I think it's not fair also for the congregation and the clergy and everything. I mean, if you're gone all the time, you always have subs. You're not really giving your 100% to your job, and I don't think that's the way it should be. So, and I really liked anyway being in an academic setting. So for me, it was pretty clear that I wanted to play concerts and teach somewhere. So for the next 3 years, I finished a doctorate, and then I started concertizing, I guess, a bit more intensively. And then when I graduated, I applied for jobs, and then I got the position at Baylor.
Right away.
So,
run right out of the door.
Yeah, I was lucky.
Isn't that great?
And it was funny because I went there and I didn't know anybody down there. And I had been to Texas only once, and I had told myself that of all the states, that's the one where I would never want to live. And it has nothing to do with, well, I mean, it has a lot to do with Texas itself, but, you know, it's the place where I was had a lot of malls and highways, and it wasn't especially beautiful, and it was very flat. And if you've ever been to Canada, you'll know that this is probably, like, you know, one of the most beautiful countries in the world. Know that I'm not biased, but
not biased. Yeah, no,
not
biased. No bias whatsoever.
So I had been to Texas and thought, like, so I went down to Baylor, and then I met the people who would become my colleagues, and they were just all so nice. I mean, they were such lovely people.
Oh,
and that
cool.
I think was the main reason for me taking
you found a home.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And you continued to perform all over the place.
Yes, yeah. I'm very lucky. They're very supportive of it. Actually, they're happy for me to be on the road quite a bit.
Well, I think they know that the greatest teachers are always the ones out still doing. You know, some people say those who teach can't do.
Uh-huh.
But I just don't think that's true.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't think so.
I think those that are great teachers, I studied with John Weaver. And
uh-huh.
You know, it was so much fun to go to a concert and hear him play. And often he would teach the pieces that he learned that previous summer.
Yeah.
That was kind of his mode.
Oh, that was his mode.
You know, so he would learn a bunch of new pieces, and then he would play them all over the place, but also teach them all year. You know, so we were kind of playing those same pieces. We were hearing him play.
Yeah, I think that's
concerts.
Smart. Because when you learn music yourself, you get a different insight into it than if you're just teaching it.
Yes, I think so, too. You know, you realize that there's a little tricky part right here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. You know, rather than just where your student bumbled. And it was sort of fun. You know, I put in a little trill someplace and you go, I never thought of that. But then two concerts later, I'd hear him put in the same trill.
Yeah.
It was great. So he was kind of learning from us. He was a wonderful teacher, just a gifted man. Of course, taught at Juilliard before.
Yes, but I knew him a little bit because he was still in New York when I was at Juilliard.
Yes,
what a wonderful person.
Oh, just a gem of a person, still is.
Yeah.
And but what a legacy. And now you continue that legacy. You know, isn't it fun to have received it from a great artist like Paul and now give it away to new students? You know, it's.
Well, we try at least.
Yes, I think it happens. You know, I'm sure you have great students who are just eating up every word as you did, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
I see it in David Ball here at the campus. You know, I see so much of Paul in his playing, the way he uses. David just played a wonderful recital a week or so ago, and it was just amazing to hear him utilize this organ. And I know he got that gift from Paul.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just it's a wonderful gift. So your concerts have taken you to organs all over the place. Do you have a favorite?
That's very difficult. I mean, that's going to sound really stupid, but I like organs that sound good. I don't really have favorite in terms of aesthetic. Obviously, you know, you play the Wanamaker, and, you know, isn't that the most wonderful organ in the world?
It is pretty fun, isn't it?
Yeah. But then in some ways, you know, you might play some... I took my students to Europe last year so we could study organs over there. And
how lucky.
We went to the Martini Kerk in Röningen and like talk about a totally different aesthetic. But in its own way, that organ is just as beautiful or Christchurch Spitalfields in London. I mean, it's not really the type of music I play the most often, but I think I can appreciate how beautiful these instruments are.
Yes, it's really fun to just explore the stops of these organs. And
how much personality
the
they have.
Yes, and how that personality not only influences the way you play, but influence composers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think of the French organs and the colorful pieces of the early French.
Yep.
You know, and how those instruments and spaces influence the music.
Yep.
And then we bring those over to our Moller artiste in the dry room and think, well, that's not a very interesting piece.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is, you know. Sometimes we're so lucky now in this age to be able to hear these instruments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people like in my time, several generations before you.
Maybe one or two.
we couldn't hear all those instruments. You know, people like Diane Bish and E. Power Biggs, you know, were beginning to blaze the trail and let us hear European organs. But I've told this story on the radio before. I went to the University of Pacific in Stockton for my undergrad, and we would drive to San Francisco and we'd race into Tower Records, and there'd be about 20 organ albums there, you know, and it was never a piece you were playing, but it was so much fun to go and see if there would be one new organ album somewhere
that you could get.
And now we have the whole world, you know. You can listen to any one piece in 12 different versions on 30 different instruments.
Yeah, on YouTube. Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
it's a wonderful time
and a
wonderful exchange of those sounds for our students to be able to listen to. It's really a remarkable time for the organ. So where do you see the organ going?
A lot of people are pretty pessimistic about it, and I guess there are some reasons to be a bit worried. But at the same time, you know, I think organ playing has never been at such a high level.
I'm so happy to hear you say that, because I agree. When you think of some of the wonderful players like Paul, and even like yourself and David and these wonderful young players, nobody played like that.
First of all, there wasn't
scholarship.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, in my time, the scholarship wasn't there because the introduction to all these instruments wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were just beginning, you know, and we went racing to Europe. But now the students of those European teachers are teaching in our universities, you know, and spreading that, that, you know, maybe my generation had to go to France to study with Langlais and Marchal. But now the students of Langlais and Marchal
are in this
are
country,
teaching in our universities.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, but I think, as you said, I think it's, you know, the people who are superstars like Paul, but also even your average, but even your average church organist, I think the level is probably much higher than it was in the past, like across the border, I think.
Well, and I think the churches that have beautiful instruments, not 30-year-old Allens and Rogers, but have a beautiful pipe organ, even small, not necessarily Hazel size or First Congregational size, are the ones attracting the organists who are coming.
And the other thing I was going to say is, so the organ playing is at a high level, but organ building is also incredible these days. I mean, you look at all the new instruments that are being built, and by all sorts of builders. It's not, you know, I think, like, you think of the 20s and you had Skinner doing amazing work, but the other ones, right, not so much perhaps. But nowadays you might have like 30 builders putting out...
Yeah, small ones as well.
Yeah, putting out organs that are like real gems. So I think that's also very positive.
Yes, I think it's a good time, and the number of concert halls that have
steps
it up, you know, which gives us a whole other dimension to the organ rather than just church work. You know, it's quite wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, we have to hear you playing some more, and we're going to be back in just a little while. But one of the things that you've done is make arrangements of orchestral pieces.
Yeah,
is that something you love to do?
Yeah, I mean, when I was a teenager, I'd spend all my free time listening to orchestral music. That's what I like. So obviously it makes sense for me to play that on the organ. So this is an excerpt from Prokofiev, Romeo and Juliet. When I lived in Paris, my roommate gave me a CD of that work before he left. So that's how I discovered the piece. And then when I was thinking of music to play, that seemed very good choice.
And do you begin with a piano reduction, or do you begin with the orchestral score?
I just go from the full score.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and where are you playing this piece?
This was at a in a chapel of a private boys' school in England.
Wow.
Tunbridge School. It was a Marcusen organ.
Wonderful. Isabel Diemers playing Prokofiev. You are listening to Music from the Tower. This is Relevant Radio, and we will be right back with a lot more from our wonderful artists today. This is Music from the Tower. We're in our final stretches here with Isabel, and it is just such a pleasure to get to know you and to get to find out all these things. You just heard a little arrangement of a Prokofiev piece from Romeo and Juliet that she arranged herself from the full score. It was brilliant with all those organs and colors. And so is that something you like to do? Have you done others?
I like to do that a lot. I do maybe 2-3 transcriptions a year, depending on what I need. And I've been trying to do some for big organs, like, you know, something more like maybe not the size of the Wanamaker, but orchestral instruments. But then it's also good, I find, to have some that will be for smaller organs, even sometimes organs that have no pistons. So then when you go for a concert, you can play a broader variety of music.
Yes. And is an organ like the Wanamaker would certainly inspire these kind of transcriptions.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
These big string divisions and all these colorful reeds. And,
exactly, yeah.
But what do you do when an organ doesn't have all that? Does it still work?
I think it still works, but you have to be very selective with which music you're doing. You know, Wagner on a 2-manual Schlicker with no pistons is probably not going to sound
not
right.
Not going to be.
But something like Prokofiev might actually work really well because his orchestration is very different anyway.
And here in Los Angeles, are you doing a transcription?
I'm doing 3 movements from Mendelssohn's Reformation Symphony, which is the first transcription I did when I was a doctoral student.
The very first one?
Yeah, I brought it back for the Reformation anniversary last year.
Oh, okay.
So I'm probably going to shelve it again soon. But in the meantime, it's been really fun to get back to Mendelssohn.
And so tell me a little bit about what it's like to be a woman organist, a woman artist. You know, is that something that you had to now went at the university? You replaced Joyce Jones. She was certainly one of the featured concert artists all over the place. She played in national conventions for years. I remember her playing community concerts.
Yes.
Even in smaller towns, they would bring in these people in a community concert series. And she was one of the ones that came to Stockton when I was a student.
Yeah, I think she was very keen on doing this, really introducing organ music to the masses.
Yes.
Really, in places where you would really wouldn't have pipe organs, maybe, or something like that, so that everybody could be exposed to it.
And think of somebody like a Diane Bish.
Yeah.
You know, there's certainly woman role models, but there many concert organists are men.
Mm-hmm.
So how's that feel?
Personally, I find there's maybe too much of an emphasis on it. I mean,
on women, men.
Yeah, I mean, I want people to invite me because they think I play well, not just because I'm a woman and they have a certain quota to fill. And I mean, I think some of our organizations, I won't name them, but, you know, sometimes I think they're just pushing it too far. If you have like 5 performers and the 5 best ones you can find are guys, well, I'd say just go ahead and hire 5 guys. I mean, but maybe I can say that because I'm a woman. But
well, that's very open of you.
I don't really like when people tell me like, "Oh, we're doing a concert series. It's only women this year, and we invited you." So what is? Are you telling me you wouldn't have invited me otherwise? You invited me just because I'm a woman. I don't really like to be told that. So
well,
I think
that might be true of some women. But let me tell you, everybody's inviting you because you are phenomenal. You are sensational, and they're inviting you because you were one of the great artists of our day.
Yeah.
But you're right. It's very frustrating. Planning a convention, planning a concert series, and often being criticized, well, you have no women. Well, you have only male conductors.
Yeah,
male organists. You have, you know, but it's very difficult sometimes.
Yep.
And I, like you, I don't want someone lesser just because I have to fill my woman quota.
Yep, I agree. Or, you know, women are... you know, somebody who's blue with yellow dots or something.
Yeah, but it's wonderful to have an artist like you in a university setting, and even replacing somebody who was also a woman in a university. I mean, when you think of, there were so many women who were really key figures. Think of Eastman School. All of these places that had women, Marilyn Mason at University of Michigan, they had women in the departments. You know, and when you think of the average church organist, you think of the little old lady who plays the organ, you know. But to have somebody who's not a little old lady, who's a wonderful young woman like you, and being a great concert artist, not just great because you're a woman, not just great because somebody's filling their quota, but just great because you're great. And we are so happy you're here with us. The final piece we're going to hear is by a woman, and it's a Canadian. So tell us a little bit about that. Is there some folks that feel, well, you got all your training, why didn't you go back to Canada to teach or to play?
Yeah, actually, a lot of Canadians sort of wonder what I'm doing in Texas, but those are the people that have never been south of the border, so I don't think they really quite understand. Texas has a very bad reputation in other parts of the world, but you think about all the money that they have, and you go to Dallas, and you know every corner has some gigantic church with a multi-million dollar instrument.
Huge instruments, don't they?
Yeah, huge instruments, and very good also, like really great quality. So in a way, Texas is a little bit of an organ mecca.
Well, and that, too, came from an organ teacher, Robert Anderson at SMU.
Yeah.
Those organs didn't just happen.
Yeah.
You know, they happened because he really pushed them not to have another molar or another slicker or another, but he pushed them to have French instruments, and especially French. But, you know, I was fortunate enough to go on a tour with him to Europe. And he took us to 18 countries.
Oh, my God.
And we went everywhere. And he had the complete works of everyone in his briefcase. And we played every possible organ in the universe, you know. And he brought all these great teachers to Texas, to SMU. And, you know, so it takes a person like that.
Yep.
And there you are at a university, my friend. You're going to be one of those people bringing people there and having conferences that all of us come to attend. And
actually, one thing that has been fun for me is being able to invite people. Just this year, I think we'll have something like 6 or 7 people coming in to teach and doing workshops. And
it's
been great for the students, but for me too. I just feel I've learned so much just by watching master classes and,
of course,
and then talking with the students and seeing what the people said in lessons. But
another great woman teacher for me was Anne Lubunsky at Duquesne University.
Uh-huh. Yes.
And Anne is a champion of bringing all these people. Some were her teachers, Marsha, Langley.
Yep.
They all came multiple times, Robelot, all these great teachers. But she brought others from other places where she wasn't. And, you know, we all got a chance to play for them, even though those of us who had graduated, I was an adjunct faculty member. But I got a chance to play for all these great teachers. And it was so wonderful to learn from them. You know, so that idea of making a little organ mecca is pretty exciting stuff.
Yeah. But I think
back
to Lorraine. Yeah, so in 2009, I played for the RCCO convention in Toronto, and they asked me for a Canadian program. So my friend at Juilliard, Ryan Jackson, had been playing a lot of her music. So I asked him, you know, do you have anything of hers that I could play?
And so tell us the name of this composer.
Oh, sorry. Rachel Lorraine is her name. And as it turns out, actually, when I was a teenager, there was a TV show in Quebec called Do Your Scales. It was with kids who played instruments and things like that. And,
wow.
And so I had been on the program. And as it turned out, they always had like a professional musician every week. And the week I was there, she was a professional musician.
Cool. So you actually met her.
I met her, but I don't really remember it. I just, you know, my parents still have the TV show that I haven't watched. But I think she remembered me because I was playing a piece that had glissando, and so my fingers had been bleeding a bit. So I played with Band-Aids, and I think she remembered me as the kid that played with all the Band-Aids. Anyway, so I learned her one of her pieces, and then she sent me a note to thank me after the convention, and so we became friends. And then when I was playing for planning my program for the 2010 AGO convention in Washington, I asked her if she had something that could bookend the program, and she suggested the first and last movement of her first symphony. And so what we will hear now is the toccata that ends the symphony. And I was playing on that lively Folcher organ at St. Patrick's in Washington that's very French.
Oh, very
so I said,
famous.
You know, if you
so
have something,
beautiful.
Yeah, if you have something that's French, you know, that would be wonderful, perfect for the organ.
So this is a giant toccata?
That's a giant toccata. It's about, you know, maybe eight or nine minutes
wonderful.
Or something. But,
and by a woman composer and a Canadian.
Yes.
And so we have been enjoying this time with Isabel Diemer. And we have had such insight into your world as a performing artist, as a university teacher, as a Canadian living in our country. It's just been such a pleasure to get to meet you right here on the radio in front of everyone.
Yes.
And so thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thanks for having me here.
It's absolutely our pleasure. I encourage all of you until the next episode of Music from the Tower to go out and listen to live performance. And if you're lucky enough, maybe one of those live performances might be Isabel Diemer's. Thank you for being on the show. Thank you for listening. And we'll be with you next time on Music from the Tower.